Thank you. Good morning. So I did a lot of my early work with cell adhesion and extracellular matrix, and I put in some fairly old stuff, but I hope it will serve as a basis for discussion. And then lately I have been working on vascular specialization and what I call vascular zip codes, and I'll show you some of the latest work at the end of the talk. So there are basically two kinds of matrix in the body. The diffuse matrix, and I'm not showing a tissue here, I'm actually showing a cell culture, but it tells the main points of what this kind of a matrix does. It's in between the cells and it's diffuse there. And the green here is actually fibronectin, and the red rounded things here are the cells. This is pretty much what loose connective tissue looks like, except that, of course, it isn't just fibronectin. It is many different proteins and also proteoglycans that form a complex and serve many functions that we're going to go into in some detail in a moment. The other main extracellular matrix type is a basement membrane, and it's typically under an epithelial cell layer, which you have here, and it has a very different composition from the diffuse matrix that is actually shown here. A different collagen than in this matrix, or a number of collagens actually, laminins, more than fibronectin, and some other proteins that interact with laminins, a different proteoglycan family than the ones that are in the loose connective tissue, and so on. So, but they function quite similarly, only the loose connective tissue is mostly occupied by fibroblasts, which make it, and the basement membrane is a joint product of the fibroblasts on this side and the epithelial cells on the other side. Well, I already mentioned a number of the components. There are lots and lots of collagens. In fact, it's the most common protein in the mammalian body. And you probably know that the defining feature is the triplet of GlyXY. Every third amino acid has to be a glycine for the collagen to be able to make the triple helix that it is composed of. But there are some other ones that are not fibrillar mostly, and type 4 in basement membrane is a typical one in that category. Fibronectin is sort of the founding member of the glycoproteins in the matrix and the prototype adhesive protein. We're going to talk much more about that. Betronectin is very similar in its function to fibronectin, but it's not primarily a matrix protein. It's a lot of it is present in plasma. Fibronectin is also a plasma protein, whereas laminins are in the basement membrane, as are nitrogens. The one interesting point about the plasma versus tissue of fibronectin and betronectin, these are cell adhesive proteins. Cells like to bind to them. But if you have a plasma protein, the interaction of the cell receptors and the single fibronectin molecule is not really sufficient to produce much of a result. This is a low affinity interaction, and it's built the way that in such a way that when fibronectin is on a surface, which it is in a matrix, it's insoluble there, then you have many fibronectin molecules interacting with many cell surface receptors, and this interaction is productive. It is the basis of cell adhesion. Well, I'll show you some examples of that in a moment. Now, there are also a number of tenacins, and they're also adhesive proteins, but their roles are rather specific and not terribly well understood still. And the same is true of these proteins. Now, proteoglycans are characterized by the fact that there is a glycosaminoglycan component, a polymeric glycan component attached to a core protein. And they, for a long time, they were kind of just studied by old-fashioned biochemistry. We cloned the first core proteins, and that started establishing them not as a chondroitin sulfate proteoglycan, but they actually got names, some of them from us, like Decre. And the same is, while chondroitin sulfate proteoglycans obviously have a chondroitin sulfate and dermatan sulfate, a glycan bound to them, cell surface and also basement membranes have heparan sulfate proteoglycans. And then there's a lone special category hyaluronic acid, which is also a polymeric glycan. It doesn't have sulfate as these two do, and doesn't have a core protein, and is mostly in tissues too. It retains water and provides much of the consistency of tissue.
What are the percentages of these different components?
I can't really answer that question offhand. The collagen is the most prevalent one, but how that relates to, say, hyaluronic acid, I don't really know.
Not the big four categories that you had, I meant.
Collagens, glycoproteins, and proteoglycans. I don't know.
Thank you.
And I already mentioned that fibronectin and vitronectin are, fibronectin is both a plasma protein and tissue protein. Vitronectin is primarily a plasma protein. Some of it is in tissues as well. Fibrinogen is an adhesive protein that is primarily a plasma protein, and so is von Willebrand factor.
I guess just kind of follow up question. That was addressed, you know, the ratio of these different components of ECM.
You Googled it already?
No, I was wondering. The
ECM notes.
Whether the ratio changes depending on the tissue that you're looking at and how much difference there is, I think.
I don't think that's. Hyaluronic acid is important, for example, in tumors. When there's a lot of hyaluronic acid, the interstitial pressure of the tumor tends to be higher because it attracts water. And if it is artificially lowered, and people treat tumors actually with hyaluronic acid, hyaluronidase, to digest the hyaluronic acid, that lowers the interstitial pressure in tumors. That's an important issue in cancer treatment, because when the interstitial pressure in the tumor is high, the flow of fluid is mostly out of the tumor. And if you try to get the drug in there, the drug will have to swim upstream. So that's one change in ratios that is important. Another one that I can think of is that tumor cells that start from the epithelium, one of the first things they do is they degrade basement membrane, and then they also are less efficient in assembling new matrix than normal cells. And this is thought to make it easier for the tumor cells to invade into the surrounding tissue and eventually metastasize.
Is there a normal function for this breakdown of the basement membrane? Can normal cells do this as well?
Yes. It's one of the normal functions is that if you look at the mammary gland, when it lactates, it develops a lot of additional epithelial tissue sitting on a basement membrane. And one of the key events when the mammary gland involutes after the end of lactation is that the basement membrane is destroyed.
May I ask one question?
Sure.
In fact, I'm wondering how tumor type specific these compositions are, and if one can conclude when one studies one tumor to the, and how far one can conclude to the mechanism in other tumors. Whether there's a classification, or maybe one has to look at it tumor-specific, or whether one can more or less conclude most of the key mechanisms are the same.
Well, there is a generality to it. And that, I think, comes from the fact that there are, when cells get activated, they express different integrins. Those are the matrix adhesion receptors we'll talk about next. And as a result, there are changes in matrix assembly and adhesion and so on. But because one of the characteristics of tumors is that all the cells are activated, that gives it a generality. We'll talk a little bit later about an important issue. Which is that some tumors have much more matrix than other tumors, and that's important in how treatable the tumors are, and how the tumor cells and the matrix cells talk to one another. We'll get to that later on. So here's, and I'm sorry if this is redundant and you've already seen this on this course, the scheme of the integrins. They are heterodimers, so there's always an alpha subunit and a beta subunit. And some beta subunits are quite promiscuous. They associate with many alpha subunits. And it's the combination of the two subunits that gives the integrin its specificity, not an individual component. Beta 1 can associate, although fairly rarely, with the subunit alpha V, which defines its own family. So while this family is defined by the beta subunit, the alpha V integrins are defined by the alpha subunit, which can combine with several betas. And then there's an outlier. This is the main integrin of platelets. and is functioning in platelet aggregation.
Is there some tissue specificity of these bearings? And is it conserved in evolution or not?
Well, they are, I'm not sure what you mean by conserved in evolution. They're all...
So in mouse, for example, is it the same in mouse?
Yes. They, as you go down the complexity of the organism, they have fewer integrins. Mm-hmm. The Drosophila, the last I looked at, three, as opposed to all these in mammals. But they work the same way, and they, their binding specificities are very similar. and we'll talk a little bit about their binding specificities.
They evolved by some kind of paralogous, so they're parallel to each other? They're ortho, how do they? So these are just, so I'm trying to say, is there a unique thing you can go backwards to understand?
Yeah, they're all homologous. The beta subunits are all homologous with one another, okay, fairly closely, something like 70%. And if you go to one species to another, like with beta 1, then it's in the 90 plus percent range. So that's how you define them, by homology. The leukocytes have their own integrins that play a very important role in the leukocyte migration and targeting of typically inflammatory tissues. Oops. Oh, no, I need to go back. Okay, so I'm not going to get in any detail into the structure of all these cryptins we've talked about. Here's just an example of a fibronectin subunit. It's a dimer with two subunits that are attached by a disulfide bond here. And it illustrates a couple of points. One is that the matrix proteins typically are multi-domain proteins. And there are three different kinds of domains in fibronectin: type 1, type 2, and type 3, that make up the molecule. These individual domains then have individual activities, like the N-terminus of fibronectin binds to both heparin and, probably most importantly, to fibrinogen. And the type 2 domains are central to the ability of fibronectin to bind to gelatin, which is denatured collagen. So fibronectin doesn't bind well to collagen that has a perfect triple helix. But if you open up the triple helix, and in our body, the collagen triple helix actually does breathe. It opens and closes. It's close to the melting point of the triple helix. So that provides binding sites for fibronectin. Of course, the gelatin gives a is the basis of how fibronectin is isolated. We first noticed this interaction many years ago, and then we went to a supermarket and bought a huge bag of gelatin and made an affinity column with it, which gave us the ability, us first and then everyone else, to make unlimited quantities of fibronectin. That's how it was sequenced from the protein and all that. All this structure could be figured out by cleaving the molecule in different places and so on. So on with the different sites in the molecule. Here's the cell attachment, main cell attachment site, and we'll talk much more about that. And then there's another heparin binding. and fibrinogen binding site there. So typically, almost all the matrix glycoproteins, first of all, the matrix proteins bind to one another. They form complexes. They typically all interact with proteoglycans, and they have cell attachment sites. So what does the matrix then do? One fundamental function is, of course, that it keeps us together. It forms the scaffold of our bodies. In the extreme, it's the bone that exemplifies that. But all our tissues contain a matrix, and it provides the scaffold for tissue structure and tissue architecture, because like a basement membrane separates epithelial cells from the connective tissue underneath and so forth. A matrix also is required for cells to be able to proliferate and to be able to stay alive. And we'll have more to say about that. I'll have more to say about that in a minute. The cells get the traction for mobility and motility from the matrix. And when the cells traffic in the blood, their attachment and extravasation depends on integrins and in the tissue, the matrix. And finally, the matrix also has influences differentiation. Depending on which matrix you put the cells on, their differentiation may change. That's particularly important with the cartilage, where if the cells are round and poorly attached, they stay as cartilage cells. But if they attach well, they become more like fibroblasts.
What is the relative importance of integrins versus cadherins? Cadherins is only for cell-cell interaction, not for cell-matrix interaction.
That is correct. They serve different functions. I don't know that there you can. You're comparing apples and oranges if you try to figure out their relative importance, because both are fundamentally needed.
But are they encountered in all of those processes you see? So is it are they parallel?
Well, except that the matrix architecture and is obviously they despine cells to other cells. And so it's less important there. And cadherins are anti-motility. Extracellular matrix proteins are pro-motility, or integrins are pro-motility. At least there it gets complicated, because the fibronectin binding integrins and vitronectin binding integrins are required for motility more than some of the integrins that bind to, for example, laminin and keep epithelial cells on the basement membrane. So I like, excuse me. Guess we have no water. So let me thank you. I appreciate it. I already gave one lecture this morning that lasted for an hour. So I'm losing my voice. Anyway, I hope we can manage. I like this picture because it illustrates a couple of points. First, that cells interact with matrix proteins and that mediates cell adhesion. And the other one is that cells go to where they find adhesion. So what was done here was fibronectin as a purified protein was coated on the plastic surface. And the control is albumin, which is not an adhesion protein. And then cells were put onto the surface. And you can see that these cells have attached to the surface as opposed to the cells put on albumin. And they also spread. They become flat. So this would be the size of a cell initially, and then they become very flat on fiber.
When you say cells go to where there is adhesion, you mean a short wave interaction?
I'm sorry?
if you said that cells go to, if there is adhesion, or where there is adhesion, Do you mean by a short range interaction, so the cells
It's short. It's adhesion, moving one step and so forth. So here's Bob Klebe was one of the, thank you, one of the early fibronectin researchers. He did the following experiment. He took some kind of a surface. And he put fibronectin solution into the inkwell of his printer and printed the words fibronectin onto that surface, and then put cells on. And you can, this is that kind of staining. So you can see that the cells attached to where the fibronectin was printed onto the surface didn't attach elsewhere. And here he did the opposite here. Covered the whole surface with fibronectin and then burned the letters there. Now you see that the burned area did not attract the cells. Just makes very graphically the point that I mentioned earlier. Cells go to where they find the best adhesion. So almost 30 years ago, we were studying the cell attachment function of fibronectin, and we ended up being able to show that the cell attachment activity of fibronectin was essentially just focused on three amino acids, an arginine, glycine, and aspartic acid, which in the fibronectin molecule is in a loop that projects out of the molecule, as we predicted here. This was just a guess at that time. we said that we needed a tetrapeptide, and the reason is that the arginine, glycine, and aspartic acid, if you just have those three alone, it isn't active. You need to block the C-terminus of the aspartic acid to have it be active in cell adhesion. And the simplest way of blocking it is to put another amino acid there. That's why initially it was RGDS, but only RGD is needed. S can be almost anything, including an amide group.
Is that the reason people use cyclic RGD?
No, that's because they have a better affinity, and I have something about that right here. So now, RGD is the central recognition motif for a number of integrins, all of the alpha V integrins, alpha 2B, beta 3. And some of the beta 1 integrins. But and that makes you wonder how the specificity is generated in the system. And the answer, there are two elements to the answer. One is that it's the presentation of the RGD sequence that is important. And that can be mimicked with cyclic peptides, because they, rather than a linear peptide, which are floppy, they have more structure. For example, this peptide, which has two disulfide bonds, even though it's only a 9 amino acid peptide, has enough structure so we could determine it with magnetic resonance studies. And because of the two disulfide bonds, the molecule can take two structures depending on the orientation of the bonds. They're either this way or parallel. And the other conformations are not possible because the two systems are too close to one another to form a disulfide bond. So these two are the possible structures. And it turns out that they have a different presentation of the RGD, and only one of them is active in promoting cell adhesion. So the presentation of the RGD sequence does matter. And that's how one element of the specificity of matrix protein.
How do you get this conformal transition by hydrolysis? How does it go from one form to the other? What is the?
Because the disulfide bond arrangement is different. You can have either one connecting to number four of the systems and two to three, or one, three, two, four, and that determines the structure.
Sure, but what is the triggering? What triggers the transition?
Well, they are pretty stable once they have formed. But if you just synthesize this peptide and let it cyclize by itself, you get both.
I see.
And why that is, I'm not sure. Just probably chance.
So these are actually the isomers. They are chemically completely identical. They just have a different shape.
That is correct. Well, accepting the disulfide bond arrangement. Of course, that is a chemical difference. But otherwise, they are identical, yes. The other element in making integrins specific for one matrix protein as opposed to another is that sometimes the binding site isn't as simple as just the RGD site, and the surface is larger. That's the case with one of the prototypic fibronectin receptor. It spans not only the RGD type 3 domain, but also connects with the next domain. That gives it more affinity for fibronectin than for etronectin. The integrins can form basically three different kinds of interacting structures. The one that we're mostly talking about today is the one where an integrin binds to an RGD and, in this case, the surrounding or adjacent motif in extracellular matrix. The leukocyte integrins bind to some matrix proteins, but their main targets are cell surface counter receptors, like ICAMs. There are three of them. And then the platelet receptor forms, it sandwiches fibrinogen in between the same integrin on the surface of two different cells. That's the third way of getting adhesion to work through integrins. Now the integrins, and that's why they are called integrins, they connect extracellular matrix to the intracellular cytoskeleton. They integrate between the two. There is an intricate complex of cytoskeletal proteins making the connection, and they actually regulate the activity of integrins. That's called inside-out signaling. Tailing, in particular, the particular state of tailing determines how active this integrin is going to be that is attached to it in binding to the matrix. And then, of course, they also signal outside in, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. There are phosphorylation events that occur as a result of the attachment of an integrin to the matrix, and so on.
What is getting phosphorylated?
Pardon?
Tell us what is getting phosphorylated then?
Well, FAK is the main protein, the early one. CAS is also phosphorylated. It's focal adhesion kinase. And of course, there's SARC and a number. There are more of them in this slide. Oh, no, the next one.
Is there a connection between this FAK and this signaling to the MET pathway?
Yes. Well, can we come back to that when the slide comes up? So I was first going to talk about the cytoskeletal connection and what that does. It, of course, determines the morphology of the cell, and cell spreading is largely a function of what the integrin cytoskeletal association does. But one important thing that this association also does is it makes it possible for the cell to assemble matrix out of fibronectin. Now, fibronectin comes out of the cell as a soluble molecule. And as I told you, it's also present in plasma. The cell can take this soluble protein and make fibrils out of it. And the way it does it is that it stretches the fibronectin molecule, which is globular initially, by two integrins binding to the RGD sites, and then the physical stretch opens up the molecule. It exposes binding sites that mediate fibronectin binding. That's how you form a fibril.
Is this fibrin in detention?
Yes, it is. Then when it is attached to integrins, it is under tension. It's that tension that creates the additional binding sites. So another important thing that cell matrix interaction does is it is actually required for cells to stay alive. Now, I think the meaning of this interaction is that, or this phenomenon is that, if a cell comes off its normal place and is no longer attached, it undergoes apoptosis, because you don't want your cells floating around in the body and establishing themselves in places where they shouldn't be. That's actually the basis of metastasis. And it's interesting that it's possible to show by using combinations of different integrins and different matrix proteins that it's not only just attached or not attached. A cell can also attach perfectly well, but if the matrix and the integrin attaching to it is not the right combination, it also ends up dying, undergoing apoptosis. And only getting back onto the right matrix keeps the cell alive. This phenomenon, apoptosis caused by lack of cell attachment, is called anoikis. That's a Greek word that means homelessness. This was discovered by a colleague of mine at Sanford Burnham. He initially submitted his paper calling this the homelessness phenomenon. And the reviewers objected to it. And one of them, made arguments such as that it was insulting to homeless people or something like that. So he found this Greek word that's become accepted now. So there are many connections between integrins and growth factors and growth factor receptors. One outline is here, and there's MEK. So they are intricately connected. And most of the time, what one sees is that the integrin-mediated adhesion is needed for growth factors to work. You can dump in a lot of growth factor. If you don't have the attachment through integrins, it won't work. It won't cause proliferation. It won't even keep the cell alive.
Do the cell growth factor receptors co-localize with integrin and yes. Do focal adhesion sites?
Yes. I'm not sure that focal adhesions are the focal point of those interactions, but the observation is that if you stimulate a growth factor receptor, such as the insulin receptor or insulin-like growth factor receptor, PDF receptor or VEGF receptor, with its ligand, which causes phosphorylation of the receptor, it then becomes associated with integrins. So you can bring it down with an integrin. And particularly the integrins that are responsive to that are expressed by activated cells, the alpha V integrins and alpha V beta 1, which are the RGD dependent integrins. Sorry?
The dash versus solid line?
Well, yeah, this just means that it isn't all that clear. Maybe it is now. This goes back some 10 years.
Excuse me, I had a question to the
yes.
Can you go back, please? Yeah, I see quite often this kind of schemes, and, which means in this case that if ACK is if activated, then this is permissive for cell-cycle production. But can one put it into numbers? I mean, does it mean that it takes place with probability 1, with a certain rate, with a certain probability? And how does it translate into numbers? Because if you really want to translate it into what happens on the cell and tissue level, then you need numbers.
Right. Well, that's not really something I am into, but that's up to you guys to figure out. But you're right. It gets very complicated, and just what is going to happen is going to be dependent on a lot of other things.
And even people in 7 is you have a competition in a way. So
Yes. But it's just now with systems biology, those kinds of questions are beginning to be asked.
They model the pathway, but they don't model the response on the cell.
Yeah. Maybe I can ask a related question in a little bit different way. So this pathway diagram represents exactly what phenotypes. So for example, suppose this FACT SARC is mutated.
Uh-huh.
Or suppressed, there's still the other pathway available.
Yes.
Right? Through RAS signaling.
So the likely result is that RAS is activated less strongly because it doesn't.
So is that sufficient for cell cycle progression?
Well,
what is the phenotype of a knockout of FACT SARC?
These cells are poorly, they survive poorly and they proliferate poorly.
Poorly means more slowly?
Yeah, and they die more easily.
So increased apoptosis and slow down cell cycle.
Say it again.
Increased probability of apoptosis or rate of apoptosis, yes, and decreased
probability of proliferation.
Rate of cell cycle.
Correct. Now, so that's all very much a network where integrins and growth factor receptors work together. Now, there is at least one pathway that seems to be entirely integrin specific. That's something we discovered a number of years ago, where this protein, BIT1, which is a mitochondrial protein located on the surface of mitochondria. Like many other mitochondrial proteins, if it gets away from mitochondria, it's pro-apoptotic. And without going into any of this detail, the important point here is that the only thing that rescues a cell after BIT1 has gotten into the cytoplasm is putting cells on fibronectin or vitronectin. You can't prevent this with any anti-apoptotic treatment or any growth factor. It only responds to integrins. So there are integrin-specific pathways, or there's at least one of those.
So this is a pathway that's active when P53 is knocked out. So this is at least an apoptotic pathway available for treatment and tumor.
Yeah, it doesn't require P53. It does work. ERK is involved, but it's not entirely clear what else is involved. TLE1 is an anti-apoptotic protein, and it competes with BIT1, so that's one pathway that gets very complicated because TLA1 is a transcriptional regulator, so when its level is down or its activity is prevented by BIT1 overexpression, many things will change in the cell.
So how does it trigger apoptosis? Does it involve the same set of caspases?
No, it's caspase independent. One of the mechanisms is TLA1. Another is inhibiting ERK phosphorylation. It actually activates an ERK phosphatase. But that's all that is known at this point.
Another question, HC is also involved in the level of calcium, intracellular calcium, that also is related to apoptosis. So
yes,
the release of calcium to the mitochondrion is involved in this, in the triggering the apoptosis, do you know?
No, there's no indication that we have found that calcium would be important in this phenomenon, because it's important in many other things. So here's an experiment done by Don Ingber's lab some time ago, where they asked the question, was it the surface area of cell attachment that was important, or was it the spreading of the cell? Remember, I showed you how cells spread on fibronectin. So the way they studied this was that they made micro-patterned surfaces where they either took just one spot that had a certain area or a number of spots that had a certain area. And these were, I think these were equal to that. And when they when they put cells on just one spot, the cells were not surviving as well as they were on an equally big surface that allowed the cell to spread, because they would bind to all these spots and it would, the cell would cover a much bigger area than it would otherwise.
George Whiteside, didn't he show that if you make these areas smaller in your middle, in the middle case, the central case, uh-huh, if you make it smaller, then eventually you also get apoptosis.
Right. It may be that there just aren't enough integrins involved anymore in that case. That then brings us to the importance of stretching of cells. And it turns out that even passive stretching of a cell promotes its well-being, its survival. And what happens is that you can do this so that you engage an integrin at the cell surface and then you stretch. People have shown a signal that affects the nucleus because the cytoskeleton spans that distance. And the end result, and this is our work some time ago, is that the nucleus gets flatter. So if you look at it from the top, you see that it gets bigger as the cell spreads. Passively, in this case, the nucleus, the in the cross section, the nucleus is flatter, and this triggers calcium signaling from the perinuclear ER to the nucleus that activates a CAM kinase. Which then activates some other things. We particularly focused on MEF2 at that time, which is a transcription factor involved in proliferation and maintenance of cell survival. So just mechanical stretch of cells will support cell survival.
But in vivo, are these cells also typically flat, like a pancake?
Yes.
In vivo?
Yes.
As well. Because I would think the matrix is...
Well, not epithelial cells. They are cuboidal, but endothelial cells and fibroblasts. Then really, fibroblasts are not pancakes. They're just very long and thin, but they are stretched.
Sorry, I'm not entirely sure I understand this whole model. So exactly what sort of deformation we're talking about. So right, this picture really reduces everything to a nuclear deformation. So therefore, so start imagining the following little experiment. Ingber and friends can confine, and other people too, can confine a cell to a small island of adhesion, right, and can make this island small enough that cell division will stop, almost.
Uh-huh.
So then in this little model, one can imagine coming in with, AFM cantilever, squishing the cell, right, squishing the nucleus, and then what? You hold it like this for 6 hours and then start dividing?
Yeah, I don't know if putting pressure on the cell from above would do it.
We've not done the nucleus.
Well, but it's stretched.
Stretch the substrate.
The nucleus is stretched.
That's different.
It's certainly different than squishing.
I'm just trying to come up with an experiment that will test that particular model. Or conversely, I'm trying to understand what is the basis for this particular model as opposed to sort of other various obvious things that involve cytoskeleton.
Right.
That engages upon stretching.
Right. Well,
experiments that have been done.
Right. I understand. I think we're back to the quantitative question. what is the relative importance of, say, the growth factor, increased growth factor activity when the integrins are activated versus the stretching, and how they interdepend on one another. I don't think anyone at this point can answer that question. So then, what's this all mean in cancer? Tumor cells, as everyone well knows, spread through blood vessels or lymphatic vessels to distant sites. That means that at some point they have to be without attachment and they have to survive it. And they do. So in general, tumor cells are more resistant to anoikis than normal cells. but they do use matrix to migrate. There's a filter and with holes that are big enough for a cell to come through. And they were originally placed on the other side of this filter, and here's one guy coming through, and that one already is through. So they are capable of not dying when they detach, and they generally are less adhesive than normal cells, but they do use cell attachment for traction in migrating. Actually, when this picture was shot, it inspired one of my postdocs to generate this one, where the cell is coming out of a hole, probably from China.
So is this like a HeLa cell, or what kind of cells?
This where melanoma cells.
Sorry?
Melanoma cells. Normal cells also migrate on the matrix. But the point I was making here is that even though tumor cells are less adhesive than normal cells, they do use the matrix to migrate along. So it's a fine balance between being non-adhesive and being able to use matrix for traction. And people have actually shown that if you make adhesion really strong, then you block cell migration. And if you make it really weak, like there's no traction, then again you block it. So it's don't want to walk on ice or in the mud. You want to be somewhere in between. Okay, so other things that relate to matrix in tumors. We already talked about the amount of connective tissue in tumors. This has recently become really important because it's thought that drugs penetrate poorly into tumors that have a lot of matrix, like this one. This is a pancreatic cancer. Pancreatic cancers typically have much more matrix than they have actual tumor tissue. And the matrix is thought to be, because it's dense and has a lot of hyaluronic acid, it's thought to be a barrier for
it's also a barrier. The other function is that it prevents the immune system to penetrate into the cancer.
That may be. That's a valid point as well. To the extent the immune system is involved in suppressing any given tumor. So here you see that all the red is connective tissue and the green is the tumor cells. So these tumors with a lot of matrix are extremely difficult to treat and very lethal, like you know about pancreatic cancer. There is a form of stomach cancer also that is similar.
So I guess I heard that pancreatic cancer is typically completely dependent on RAS. Right, the KRAS is mutated in...
It's a common mutation.
Which, of course, was sort of prominently featured in your pathway slide and was receiving signaling from integrins.
What I guess you're getting at is there a relationship between KRAS being mutated and the amount of matrix?
Right.
I don't know. I don't think anyone has looked at that. That's a good point. Okay, so I'd then like to bring you to a more recent use of the matrix technology, if you will, in some ways, and cell adhesion technology in first looking at what happens to the vasculature and in development, and then what can be done in drug targeting by using this system. So I got interested. It came from the metastasis business. There are tumors that like to metastasize in a certain place, in a way that you can't explain by hemodynamics, which in fact I don't think explains any of the specificity of metastasis. And the one hypothesis is that there's an adhesion compatibility between the tumor cell that is circulating and the endothelium of the target. So I figured that if that were true, then the endothelium of different tissues would have to be different, even though they look the same. And that is correct. In fact, there is so much heterogeneity that I talk about vascular zip codes. And the way we got into this was that instead of using tumor cells to try to figure out what might be different about the endothelium in different tissues, we used phage display libraries. Small pieces of creatine, in our case just peptides, typically 9 aminases long, were expressed on the coat creatine of a bacteriophage, such as that one phage particle expresses one peptide. And then you can make libraries that have a couple of billion peptides in them. Then the question becomes, the theory is, and practice is, that if you have a billion peptides, there are going to be a number of them that bind to whatever target you're interested in.
And you amplify that.
Then you have to be able to select those phages out of your library. So we decided to do it by selecting in vivo for homing of the phage to whatever target we were interested in, say tissue A here. Our first target was the brain and the control target was the kidney. And we showed that yes, this can be done, and that the brain endothelium expresses different markers than the kidney endothelium. And those markers made that the endothelium of that particular tissue different than the endothelium of any other tissue.
Can this explain why the brain tumors never metastasize outside and why kidney tumors metastasize everywhere?
I don't think so, because this is in the endothelium, and of course the brain tumor is in the brain. I think the likely explanation is, and I actually even wrote a theoretical paper on it years ago, is that the matrix in the brain is so different than the matrix in any other tissue, except the cartilage. The brain and the cartilage have a similar matrix, curiously enough. And what I postulated was that the matrix actually in those two tissues has a similar function. In the cartilage, it's the cushion that compresses by water squeezing out, and then it brings back the water.
Does the blood-brain barrier prevent metastatic cells from going from the body to the brain and vice versa?
No, it doesn't really. But let me finish this point. And in the brain, the important thing, because it's confined by the cranium, the important thing is that it has to be resistant to changes in volume, or resist changes in volume. And the matrix, cartilage type of matrix would do it. It turned out that nobody ever paid any attention to that idea. So anyway, we were able to isolate peptides that target a given normal tissue or target a given pathology such as malignancy. Sorry, I forgot to get back to your question. But I think the short answer is that it doesn't really matter. But the brain capillaries have a number of specific receptors, and those may well be involved in allowing cells to lodge into the brain and then eventually form a metastasis. But tumor cells seem to have a way of finding their way through the blood-brain barrier.
So, sorry, can I ask another question? This is also, could this explain why different tissue, different tumors vascularize in very different ways? Because they signal somehow, or they attach the endothelium in different ways.
Or they actually derive their endothelium from the tissue they reside in. We've tried to study that. One of our hypotheses was that we might be able to show that the same tumor, when it metastasizes in the bone, has a different vasculature than when it metastasizes somewhere else. But we were never able to find markers that would make that distinction. So I don't know.
What about the current ability that you can do single cell genomics to see differences? Did you try to do this?
Well, no, we prefer this method. And then the one main reason is that many of the markers we have found are not specific for the target tissue, it's their location that makes them specific. So tumors and tumor endothelial cells, they tend to put onto their surface proteins that in normal tissue aren't on the surface. The first one we found was nucleolin, a protein in every cell. When it's at the cell surface, it becomes a tumor marker. So if you do genomics or even proteomics, you'd never find this. It's like real estate, the location matters. So here's just some summary of what vascular zip code heterogeneity one.
If I use your metaphor just a second, the real estate, what about the mortgage? How it is in terms? No, I tell you what I mean. Because there is also the question of how well they can metabolism at different location can be different. It's not
yes,
really the marker.
It's definitely. This is only one element in the specific adhesion is only one element in metastasis. Then the host tissue has to make the right the right chemokines. And then the right has to have the right matrix and on and on. But it all starts with the attachment of the tumor cell to the endothelia of the target tissue.
I'm curious, this vascular zip code,
yes.
What surface proteins are involved in being so
right.
Variable? Is it integrins or is it in immune cells? You know that immunoglobulins can have this variety.
Yes, well, the integrins are one zip code or group of zip codes for tumors and angiogenesis in general. Otherwise, that's where the analogy breaks apart a little bit here. It isn't that there's a family of proteins with different variations like immunoglobulins that provides the code. It's any proteins. Some of them are enzymes. It's mostly from what we know, proteins that are needed in that particular tissue and situation.
There are the different numbers of certain surface proteins that's part of the zip code as well.
Well, it's actually the level of expression of individual proteins.
Okay.
And we haven't really gotten as far as combinations of them much. So we're running out of time, so I need to skip through some of them. This shows that a lot of peptides can be found that home to tumors. And here's, so we're back to integrins and RGD here. That's what I thought I'd tell this story because it relates to what we've talked about so far. So the RGD peptides, their target integrins, the alpha V integrins and alpha V beta 1, are specifically expressed in angiogenic endothelium. And just about any cell that is activated expresses these integrins. If a cell is dormant, just resting in tissue, it does not express them. So that makes these integrins a useful zip code for tumors. The RGD peptides are in the clinic in some variations and in lots of clinical trials. And they do specifically home to tumors. This is one vessel, and the red is endothelial staining, and the green is the peptide. And you can see that they coincide. And you can also do this by putting the peptide on micelles, nanoparticles. But again, they just home to the vessels. So some time ago, we found a special RGD peptide that starts out by homing to the blood vessels, but then spreads into the tumor tissue. And this, of course, as you can see here, makes it much more effective. And we call this tumor-penetrating peptides. And that they can take even a nanoparticle with them into the tissue. And this is how it works. So IRGD is a 9 amino acid cyclic peptide. Here's the cyclizing bond. Here's the RGD. And the key is that it has a basic residue here. And this forms what we call a sender motif. The sender abbreviation comes from CN rule. The second basic residue, usually arginine, has to be C-terminal for this motif to be active. So what happens is that this peptide homes to tumors because it binds to the relevant integrin. Then it gets proteolyzed here probably by a furin, cell surface furin, because this is a good furin recognition sequence. This activates the sender motif, which then binds to another receptor, neuropilin 1. And when a peptide binds to neuropilin 1, which is a membrane receptor, the binding activates a bulk transport pathway through tissue, cells and tissues. That's how IRGD works. And I schematically here, you have blood circulating here, and let's say this thing is a drug. Well, let me go back first and mention one more point. We can couple the cargo to the peptide, but we can also just give the cargo together with the peptide, and they both go into this pathway. So here's how we envision it happening. Here's the drug, and the pathway, this is an endocytic pathway, has been activated. The drug, together with the fluid that is collected in the endosome, goes into the cell and eventually out from the other side or somewhere else in the cell. And then it's ready to go to the next cell, in the next cell. This is how we get a drug delivery system that we hope to soon bring to the clinic. Here's a demonstration of what we can do with doxorubicin in combination with IRTD. We just give doxorubicin alone, this much goes into the tumor and this much to other tissues. They're pretty uniform. We combine it with IRTD acutely, much more goes into the tumor because IRGD only activates this transport pathway in the tumors, not elsewhere. So there's no change really elsewhere except maybe even less of it going to some tissues. And the end result of this is that you get a greater activity against the tumor. Now, the higher the column here, the more cell death. So if we use 1 milligram per kilogram of doxorubicin, we get this much cell death in the tumor. And doxorubicin is cardiotoxic. We get this much toxicity relative to the control in the heart.
Is this supposed to be a linear scale? The IC50 levels are linear in this region?
Well, they are to an extent because if we take 3 milligrams of the drug without IRGD, then we get cell death in the tumor that is about equal to 1 milligram without IRGD. But now the cardiotoxicity is much higher. So we can increase the activity of the drug or decrease the side effects while maintaining the activity, or do a little bit of both if we want to. This also works with a nanoparticle drug. Abraxane is a paclitaxel, one of the most common anti-cancer drugs, incorporated into nanoparticles with albumin. And as you see here, if we conjugate our IRGD peptide onto the surface of the nanoparticles, we get much more of the drug into the tumor. And the combination gives the same result. And this is reflected in treatments. This tumor is essentially insensitive to Abraxane and paclitaxel. It's resistant to the drug. But if we combine it with IRGD, either by conjugating or giving them together, we stabilize tumor growth. Here's another example that I'm going to skip over. Here's just an example of new nanotechnology that we're building, and that is particularly, of course, relevant to what UCSB is all about, material science. So we made a nanoRIM construct here, and I can't get to the details, but it has a drug-like peptide coupled to the nanoRIMs, and they are targeted to tumors. And here we're treating a glioblastoma. And the glioblastoma in these mice, it quickly kills the mice. But if we use these nanoparticles with the drug, we prolong quite a bit their lifespan. And if we, in addition, add IRGD, don't couple it, just give them together, we further prolong the lifespan. This is actually pretty impressive. These tumors have been completely resistant to any other treatment. Yeah.
Scale is days?
Days, yes. Sorry, it has dropped up. what we accomplish here is mouse days are, you know, human months. what we accomplish with IRGD here is when these nanoparticles are given alone, they just home to the tumor vessels. But when we combine with IRGD, they get the tumor vessels and then go out to get the tumor cells as well. So that explains this improvement in the activity.
How do you administer the nanoworms into the brain?
Well, this is all systemic treatment. IV.
IV?
Yes. I mean, do I have to skip all of this? We're out of time. And just summarize that homing peptides can deliver drugs, diagnostics, and other compounds to a specific target tissue. Cell, this would be an endothelial or tumor cell, and even subcellular sites, which I didn't get to. And the tumor-penetrating and tissue-penetrating peptides are a new development in this field that I think will greatly increase the applicability of that kind of technology, particularly when combined with nanotechnology. And here are the people who did a lot of the work, the last part of the work. And I should mention that I'm involved in three companies that have licensed various aspects of our homing peptide technology. Sender Inc. is trying to bring IRGD to the clinic. And here's my ranch house in above Santa Ynez Valley. Down there is the River Valley. Thanks very much. Yes.
When you administer the peptides, isn't there a problem that the immune system of the patient will develop a cognition of
I don't think so. We haven't studied it in detail, but the small peptides are not particularly immunogenic. We often try to make antibodies against peptides that come from proteins, so we get an antibody against the protein. And we employ every trick in the immunologist's book to get antibodies, and still a lot of the time it fails. And here, of course, we're not stimulating the immune system purposely anyway. So it's not been a high priority on our list of priorities. First, we have to have efficacy and so forth. But it clearly is now. If one wants to go to the clinic, that is one of the questions. So we are beginning to study the potential immunogenicity.
And you pass the phase one of the toxicity?
No, we're just in the earliest. We've done mouse toxicity. We haven't done toxicity in bigger animals. And we're kind of hoping that maybe we don't have to do that, because it's a peptide and it has a 10-minute half-life. But those are things that need to be dealt with the FDA. That connection is gone. Yes?
So do you understand the rate at which these things are stopped in the liver? Because I noticed that the liver efficacy was much higher than in other tissue. And so would systemic therapy be the way to administer this, or would you make more focal?
This meaning your nanoparticle.
Yes, your nanoparticle,
right. Yes.
Delivery.
Right.
Makes sense.
Well, in this system, the last one I showed you, the pro-apoptotic peptide we use is very toxic. And the observation that we made that really turned out to be the key is that when you put that peptide on a nanoparticle, it becomes hundreds of times more active than it is as a single molecule. That allowed us to reduce the dose and improved our targeting. So while when we used it early on, and we've used it for a number of years as a sort of a model drug, so we're peptide chemists and we can make it as a single chimeric peptide with our homing peptide. So we like it. But it's very toxic. We'd always lose some animals. in this nanoparticle study, we had slight liver toxicity evident from testing liver enzymes. Nothing dramatic, just a modest raise in liver enzymes. There were raises that went away when we stopped the treatment. So I think the system is viable. But you're right, the biggest single issue, I think, in nanomedicine is how to avoid liver uptake. People have these surface coatings and they work, but eventually everything ends up there. It's a matter of does it end up there in minutes or hours. And that really needs to be controlled better than we can now for nanomedicine to be as effective as we hope it will be someday.
Do you remember the size of the nanoparticle?
Yes, these were iron oxide. They're actually what we call nanoworms. They are 80 nanometers in length and 20 to 30 in thickness.
And I was wondering, when you were talking about this mechanical sensing by the cell nucleus, integrins are often invocated as mechanical sensors, as being able to measure the stiffness of the substrate. Uh-huh. So you must have a reason why you didn't assume that it would be integrins who do mechanical sensing rather than nucleus. Why do you have direct evidence that the nucleus is a mechanical sensor?
Well, I don't think it is a sensor. Well, it's downstream from the integrins. We knew that when we were stretching the cells that they were bound to the surface through integrins. So that part of it was already a given. And so the question became, was the modification of the nucleus important in sending signals or not? Our answer was that it is.
But it would be simply downstream, so there could be microtubules, there could be many other things involved in changing the
cell. Well, actually, we also stretched individual nuclei, and we're seeing the... Yep. So we could eliminate the role of the cytoplasm.
So a lot of cancer cells, when you just put it on a pure glass, they can just adhere, right, without any coating. So they must have to secrete a lot of matrix proteins. Are those matrix proteins encoding the zip codes that cell type specific? Which means, can I read the zip code from the cells that written on the white paper, you know?
Yes, I see your point. Yes, the adhesion to a non-treated surface tends to be slow. The tissue culture plastic is treated so that it's, I think it's highly, has a lot of amino groups, and those provide initial attachment. But then the cell makes its own matrix. It usually takes about 2 hours, and then it actually doesn't matter what you put there, the cell has made its own matrix. Now, I don't know how I could make that relate to the zip codes I talked about. It does tell you what the matrix is, does tell you what the cell likes to attach to.
And you mentioned you had a tumor zip codes, and then you also had inflammation.
Uh-huh. Yes.
How different are they?
Well, there is a lot of overlap. The main inflammatory receptor that people look at and use is VCAM1. And there is a certain amount of VCAM expression in atherosclerotic plaques and in tumor vasculature as well. But it's it's more typical of inflammation. But I think every pathology is going to turn out to have its own zip code. People just haven't looked at them that way. I'm particularly interested in, well, I particularly always talk about Alzheimer's disease. I'm not an Alzheimer researcher, so we haven't done the experiment, but I'm pretty sure that if one were to take Alzheimer model mice and do these kinds of experiments, one would find peptides that selectively home to the vasculature in the lesions. This hasn't been done.
You mentioned something about the ECM in the brain being different. Could you elaborate a little bit?
Right.
How much is there?
Yeah, it's rich in proteoglycans and tenases and hyaluronic acid. The collagen is not type 2, which it is in the bone, but the particularly typical is the proteoglycans that are shared. The brain doesn't have there's a cartilage proteoglycan of one family, and that one is not expressed or it's low in the brain, but a proteoglycan that is highly homologous with it is the main proteoglycan in the brain. And then there's hyaluronic acid, and as I mentioned, the tenases. That makes it similar, more similar to the cartilage than to any other tissue.
Okay, well, let's not.